It's time for Eco Talk with host Betsy Rosenberg.
She'll be great. She's a very smart, capable person who knows exactly what took place and will lay out the facts. And that's what the American people want to see.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
Oh, welcome to Eco Talk, and sorry, George, I wish I could return the favor, but the facts are being laid out there, and folks are getting hip, and we know what you're up to, and nowhere is that happening more so this past week than at Bill Clinton's Global Initiative in New York City. We're going to get a preview from New York Times global environmental reporter Andy Revkin. He's also the author of The North Pole Was Here, a new book on Arctic and global warming for the entire family. There is some good news coming out of that initiative. You're going to hear about it, some big bucks going to some big environmental problems. Next, we'll meet Jerry McNerney, the brave man who is challenging Richard Pombo, known in progressive circles as Pombo the Plunderer. The challenger has a career in wind energy, but does he have enough wind in his sails to beat the seven-term incumbent seemingly hell-bent on rolling back environmental progress? You decide after our interview in the second half of today's show, a really important race to keep your eye on. Also, we'll be meeting our resident eco-median, Johnny Steele. We'll see what's on his green mind. So thanks for joining us, first of all, Andy Revkin, and welcome to the daily edition of EcoTalk. You've been on as we've gone over the last couple of years on the weekends, but really nice to be in prime time with you.
Yeah, it's exciting. Thanks.
So some exciting news coming out of New York. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, there was some talk for a couple of days that something big was going to happen on Thursday, and sure enough, Bill Clinton's people said make sure to be online when this came across. And Richard Branson, the British magnate and adventurer and kind of celebrity billionaire, came up and pledged to give essentially all the profits that he would normally get from the operation of his airlines, five airlines, and a train company, his rail company,
wow,
at least through the next 10 years, he's going to invest in developing energy sources that don't contribute to global warming.
Capitalism is at its finest. That's the way we should be going.
And he said he doesn't mind if it loses money. The main thing is he thinks that he will, you know, be able to profit in this, but the main thing is his concern about the climate problem.
And has he been concerned for some time, or is this a recent eco-epiphany and conversion?
For a number of years, he's been involved, and he's expressed concern about environmental issues. I think he's had some initiatives underway, in fact, on some environmental fronts. And he actually has a company that's already started trying to figure out if there's a way to do a biofuel version of jet fuel, which would be a big deal because right now jet planes, air traffic is growing. It's one of the biggest growing areas of emissions of greenhouse gases. And for the moment, it all only comes from petroleum.
And it's going to be called Virgin Fuels, I understand. And he's investing up to $400 million. That could make a difference. That could create a market.
Yeah, and this flow of profits, at least if his companies grow at the rate they have, they anticipate that $3 billion over the next 10 years will be shunted into research on renewable energy. And by the way, that's way more than the U.S. government will spend in that same period of time.
Now,
so it's a lot of money.
Okay, and Richard Branson, I guess, credited Al Gore with helping him to see the green light?
That's right. At the press conference, he said Gore on his world tour, I think he's going to be on a world tour for the rest of his life.
Until we solve the problem, anyway.
Anyway, he came through London, met with Branson at his house, and Gore said, you know, you're in a special position here to really make a change, and maybe other people would echo what you do. And Branson came up with a pledge today.
You know, you mentioned Al Gore on his world tour. You know, Bill Maher had a funny bit about, you know, a picture of John Kerry and Al Gore up there saying, you know, where were they when they were running, when they were, you know, in office? They get very brave now when he said something like, when the only job Gore has is mowing his lawn or something, you know, speak out now. Yeah, but this, I mean, between Clinton and Gore, you really wonder, why weren't they greener when they were in the White House?
Yeah, well, I've asked them that very question, both of them.
So have I, actually, at least Gore.
And you know, they have their answers. Of course, the Gingrich Revolution happened, and they claim that hamstrung them. And
they also blame the media. They say they talked about global warming, Gore says this especially, but it wasn't picked up. And that's true to some extent, but not completely.
You cannot blame the media. I've been writing about climate for 20 years. I wrote a story in the late 90s about Clinton holding one of these all-day sort of sessions on climate at the White House. And you know, we were writing a lot of stories right through that stretch, my predecessor, Bill Stevens, that were very much addressing this as a problem, and this idea that somehow the media were taken in by a few skeptics. That has happened, and TV particularly has this sort of yay-say or nay-say approach to journalism. But it didn't happen in the New York Times, and it never happened. You know, I had a cover story, a 6,000-word cover story in Discover magazine in 1988, basically saying everything I'm saying now, just with a little bit more sense of conditionality.
Well, and maybe the public wasn't listening as carefully.
I have a feeling that's true, too.
And I suppose Katrina had something to do with that, and all these things finally reaching a tipping point. Are we at a tipping point, do you think, in consciousness about just the climate crisis? Or, as someone said, no, we're more like at the breaking point where it's almost too late. We just had James Lovelock on this week saying, at age 87, really there's nothing we can do, which is kind of an odd choice for us to put him on our first week of EcoTalk, where we really promote sound solutions for a healthier planet, the power of one. We can make a difference. But I just figured that he's not going to be around forever. He says the sequel is going to be What We Can Do About It, after he spends his book saying it's too late, and he may or may not get to that next book. So we wanted to hear what he had to say.
Yeah, well, I did, too. I interviewed him just a week ago. He was up on our video up on our website of that. Definitely, he's a provocateur and has some pretty remarkable ideas one way or the other.
The new book is called The Revenge of Gaia, all about the climate crisis. Well, there was some money raised even before Branson made this significant pledge. Did Clinton attract all those funds? And he should really run for president or office. He's got such power and charisma. Oh, he did. Is he making W look really, really bad here? I mean, look at what he's done in 3 days.
It's pretty amazing, the power of a personality, I guess. and he certainly has that. Anyone who has met with him, and I have, there's a certain something there that requires you to pay attention, whether or not you agree or disagree with what he's saying.
I think it's because he's a Leo, like I am. Birthdays are 2 days apart.
My wife is, too.
What about Bush? He was supposed to make a big announcement about some conversion that he really now sees the light and global warming is real. Was he trying to...
That was wishful thinking on the part of a lot of people, I think. I'd been tracking pretty carefully what the White House is thinking or not thinking on this. And there is some... He definitely has a group together trying to come up with things. This is for their final 2 years in office that would probably be rolled out with the State of the Union address. But nothing imminent, if you mean like this week.
Well, I read something about that on Sunday night or something, expected coming, and I said, well, Bush is probably like a groundhog coming up, and he suddenly sees the not insignificant shadow of Al Gore making a big speech at New York Law School on Monday and decided, oop, better go back. I can't trump him.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know. I wonder whether the Gore speech was timed because they had heard the rumors and wanted to trump anything the White House
said. You know, bring it on. If there's competition and who can be the biggest, you know, challenger to the continuing climate crisis, you know, let it be. Let it go. Let it fly. Yeah. Well, when we come back, we have about a minute left. We're going to chat with Andy Revkin again about some other issues in the news that he covers. The New York Times is really on top of these stories. One of them is the White House's plan to cut emissions, why that is not quite enough. And we heard from the chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality at the White House about that, and we got some good responses, so we'll share that with you, and Andy can shed some light on his view of that. Also, we want to talk about Exxon. You catch this one in the Wall Street Journal, Andy. That's pretty interesting stuff. Just give us sort of the tease, and then we'll come back and talk about it some more. Are they having an eco conversion?
Well, we'll you know, we'll see. Exxon. I do get the sense that there's an endangered species, which is the kind of bought and sold professional contrarian on climate. They're very hard to find these days.
Are you talking about the fossil fools?
Or the dinosaurs? That would be one way to put it.
The dinosaurs. Well, I wondered after, you know, Inconvenient Truth came out this summer, we had, you know, Myra Nebel from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, one of those think tanks funded to no small degree by Exxon, you know, saying these ridiculous notions about it's a hoax and, you know, it's not proven, it's cyclical, it's natural, yada, yada. And I thought after that movie comes out, they won't dare show their face. Well, maybe they're starting to have, maybe there's a delayed reaction, but we're starting to see that.
It's possible. I think Myra Nebel will be around for a long time to come, and some of the points they make are legitimate part of the discourse, which is sort of what do you do about it? That's where even a libertarian group, everyone's voice deserves to be heard in democracy on the policy questions.
Yes, but
what has been a problem has been when they enter into the media talking about the science, and I only will quote scientists in the story on a new development in climate science, like when I've been writing about the Arctic. I don't call up Myron, and I don't call up Greenpeace either. Mm-hmm. If I'm writing about the latest studies on polar bears, I call the people who are out there on the sea ice, the same people who are in the book that I wrote.
You know, and you were up
the
there.
The ones who know the issue and
That's
know
right.
the science and know the nuance and also know what's known.
We'll chat about your book as well when we come back, but I just want to mention that you say the competitive enterprise folks, Myron E. Belfo, they talk about, you know, what can be done. Well, I hear more that, you know, they question whether it's real or a problem, and they go right into, well, let's adapt. And I don't think that's the way to go either. Let's try to slow it first before we just bring technology into, quote, adapt. Stay with us. We'll be back in conversation with New York Times environmental correspondent Annie Brevkin right after these messages. Welcome back to EcoTalk. We're speaking with Andy Revkin, New York Times global environment reporter and also the author of a book out recently this year. Anyway, The North Pole Was Here, it's called. It's a book on Arctic and global warming for the entire family. It's actually kind of fun, lots of pictures. And Andy Revkin knows what he's talking about. He spent lots of time up there shivering away. And thanks for continuing to stay with us.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so as I say, shivering, let's just get back to a little bit more news on climate change. The White House this week presenting its plan to cut auto emissions. I guess they're talking about, you know, we still need to call for voluntary efforts and work with Asian countries and new technology. It seems like that's the theme. It's technology will save us. The voluntary approach will work when it seems it hasn't. Is there anything new in that announcement?
Well, there's nothing new in that announcement at all, no. In fact, what's new is there really is a growing chorus of agreement among I'm just finishing researching a very long story on this question of how do you fix it, basically, how do we get there from here?
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't a person I've talked to, including some who work for industry, who doesn't say the following. They say there's three things that have to happen. You have to have prompt integration now of the stuff we can do now, meaning make... If you're building a new coal-fired power plant, it better be the kind where you can capture the CO2 once we come up with that technology and hold on to it, pump it under the ground. And if you're building a grid, try to make it so it's adaptable, so you can have it absorb power from things like windmills and solar. And then you also need a sustained development of things that are just on the bench scale in laboratories right now at a much larger scale. And you need beyond that, to get this problem into control in the long run, in this century, right now we need an R&D program, a fundamental research program in energy, to come up with what one scientist I talked to calls the ideas we don't have names for yet.
Mm.
And not one of those things will do it on its own.
And not the first one you mentioned anyway, you know, building coal-fired power plants that have the new technology is really underway. I mean, as we speak, they're being permitted for the old-fashioned type of coal-fired power plants.
Well, right, and it's also an added problem because it's not just here, it's in China. So obviously there's merit to talking to Asia about climate. It would be irresponsible for any administration not to have aggressive ongoing engagement with the rest of the world on this question, because it is a global problem. Every power plant, taxi cab, car, truck, it all contributes to the common rise in carbon dioxide levels around the world. And that's kind of a no-brainer, many people feel.
Well, and that's one of the problems. There's a lot of talk about future technology when it could certainly be argued that we're not fully utilizing technology that's available today either.
And it's actually the other thing that's not being fully utilized, particularly in this country, is efficiency. Turning off the lights.
Using conservation.
More efficient light bulbs and doing this through having an aggressive, assertive program so that people really understand that their energy choices matter, not just in terms of the bottom line, which, of course, is a great reason to be more efficient, but also because of the climate.
And that's what we do here at EcoTalk, day in, day out now. We talk about sound solutions for a healthier planet. I like to say we pick up where Al Gore's movie left off, what we can do about it. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of scary news, right?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about Gore's speech this week was he, I think, was taking some heat for the fact that the film really was mainly about the science but not about what to do about it. And this whole speech was oriented toward the sort of what do you do about it. And
good. I hope he mentioned listen to EcoTalk on Air America weeknights.
Maybe it was in there somewhere.
I asked him to when he was on the show. I said, you got to remember that. That's what we're doing all the time here. Well, but I'm joking, of course. sort of. But, you know, we need to connect the dots. We need to give people hope. We need to learn together. It's not, nobody has the answers, not even Al Gore, who has two pretty big houses and up until recently was driving a pretty big gas guzzler. Hopefully he's traded that in for a hybrid version. You know, but it's really about, you know, waking up and now taking action and stopping the debate, right? Or giving publicity to the debate.
There'll always be things to debate about. The thing that needs to really move ahead is a recognition of the things on that laundry list that can happen now. By the way, the other thing that it's hard to find disagreement on among the people I've been interviewing about this is the need for a cap on the emissions linked to global warming. Mm-hmm. Even at places like the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian group that has long been kind of allied with business, there's an economist there who is now among those who feel that a modest cap, meaning something that will stimulate industry to make those long-term planning decisions to build that slightly more efficient thing instead of that old thing, to spur those changes in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's a recognition that this is not going away, and it's settling in for the long haul, and our approach to it has to be more. One of the other things that's come out in this reporting is our approach essentially has to be a new relationship with energy. It's not like you're just going to wake up tomorrow and fix this problem. The climate challenge is more, it really is a century-scale challenge. It's going to require action by our generation and the next three generations beyond us, as well as I said earlier, on all these fronts, sort of near-term, midterm, and long-term technology change.
Right, but we all start now. I know a lot of parents who say, well, our kids will have to deal with it. Well, what kind of attitude is that, especially when you're giving your child the best possible future, the best education, the best child care, the best, you know, there's a disconnect there, and I'm trying to tell those folks that they can help make a better tomorrow. And
yeah, well, that's a keystone for me. You know, I have two boys who are 8 and 15, 8 and 16 now, and you know, one reason I wrote this book for younger people and the families, I'm hoping that at least a few families out there will sit down and explore the issue
mm-hmm.
together,
mm-hmm.
and you'll have a situation where the kid will look up at the parent and say, so, hey, what are we doing about this?
That's where it comes from. Andy Revkin, thanks for coming on our launch week here on EcoTalk and joining us. We'll have to talk a little bit more about Exxon and how they're saying they're not going to be funding think tanks like the Competitive Institute. We'll see if that's true, in fact, next week on EcoTalk. We'll be back right after the news break.